until we get a quorum here for the purposes of holding a public hearing on Senate Bill 966. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 966 is sponsored by the Committee on Rules at the request of Mark Kramer. Requires the court to appoint attorney for child in proceeding where a person other than the parent or legal guardian is attempting to establish a relationship with child for the purposes of obtaining custody, guardianship, or visitation. A contract rights if the child's interests are not adequately represented, if custody is an issue, and if the court finds the party has a child-parent relationship with the child.
Thank you. We'll start with Mark Kramer and Julie McFarlane. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Mark Kramer. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with an emphasis in family law. In 1987, I was co-counsel to this committee. I have assisted in the drafting of several components of our current psychological parent statute and was a member of Senator Shetterly's work group in 2001 that drafted our current statute. My specialty is representing parties in disputes between parents and third parties, such as grandparents, foster parents, and guardians. In my 22 years of family law experience, I find that the interests of children in these cases are poorly represented. Children in third-party disputes need and deserve to have appointed counsel. What this bill does is to require the court to appoint counsel in certain cases. First of all, it needs to be a psychological parent case. There needs to be a case in which custody is at issue, and there needs to be a psychological parent relationship shown. Once that is demonstrated, the court must appoint counsel for a child unless it finds good cause that counsel need not be appointed. And the court can find that the party's attorneys or custody evaluator can represent the best interests of the children. I have two amendments that are attached to the packet. The proposed amendment one would also permit a court not to appoint counsel for a child if the court finds that the financial abilities of the party precludes that. And that amendment was drafted in deference to a number of concerns raised about how are the parents and the litigants going to be able to afford counsel. The bill itself provides for each district to establish a list of pro bono and modest means counsel. We already have that list in Multnomah County. It works rather well. Most attorneys represent children on a pro bono basis. Some attorneys will represent children on a modest means basis. That's an Oregon State Bar program at $60 per hour. The current law provides that a third party who has established a psychological parent relationship can petition for custody of a child. The third party must overcome the presumption that the legal parent acts in the best interest of the child. The importance of what the current law is that we don't get to what's the best interest of the child unless we overcome the birth parent presumption, and that is required by Troxell, a U.S. Supreme Court case, and the amendments to our statute in 109-119. So the reason this bill is here is essentially is that the law has changed. We no longer consider the best interest of the child on the first level. We only consider the birth parent presumption and whether the birth parent presumption has been overcome. We don't get to best interest until we get past that stage. When a third party has filed a petition and pled a prima facie case of psychological parent relationship, the court is going to be required to appoint counsel except for the exceptions that I've indicated. The court can avoid appointment of counsel if it makes specific written findings that the child's best interest can be represented by counsel for the parties. In the amendment, it expands that to the parties themselves and or if the parties can't afford counsel for the child. The law in Oregon and the country has radically changed since Troxell v. Granville and since our 2001 amendments. As I've indicated, while the best interest test is still considered, it's not considered unless and until a third party overcomes the constitutional presumption. A trial court right now, in my opinion, has discretion to appoint counsel, but there's been some controversy about that. And so there's proposed amendment 2, which makes clear than in our current statute that the court may appoint counsel for children. And I'm asking the legislature, whatever you do on 966, in principle, that you move forward at minimum with proposed amendment 2, which clarifies what most judges and what most judges already understand that to be, and that is that the court has the discretion to appoint counsel.
So amendment number 1 would continue to make it mandatory unless it was unaffordable, and number 2 would put in the statutes the current practice of making it discretionary?
That's correct, Senator Burdick. That's correct. Even at present, under discretionary determination, it's rarely done. In the 17 cases that have been appealed in Oregon since the U.S. Supreme Court decision, no counsel has been appointed to represent a child at the trial stage. In my own case of Wordley versus Blevins, at my request, for the first time, the Court of Appeals appointed counsel to represent a child. The attorney agreed to serve at the modest means rate of $60 an hour. Taking the child's perspective, the attorney agreed with the trial court and argued that the child remain with the grandparents. The trial court's decision was upheld by the Court of Appeals. What are the rights of children in these cases? In the battles between birth parents and third parties, and I've been on both sides of the coin, the rights of the children are largely ignored, except to the extent that we consider best interests at the second level. Justice Stevens in Troxell has suggested that there is a constitutional right of children to have counsel. I've quoted his material there. One of our own Court of Appeals judges in the Winchowski case on page 5 also notes that children may have an independent constitutional guaranteed right to maintain contact with whom the child has developed a parent-like relationship. We are moving to the point where the Constitution may require counsel for children. And as you know, in juvenile court cases, children are routinely appointed counsel for children. There have been some issues raised about how an attorney effectively discharges his or her responsibility to represent a child. Ms. McFarland from the Juvenile Rights Project can speak to that, but I've tried to encapsulate what the standards are in the section, a role of a child's attorney. When a child is of a mature age, the child gets advice from counsel, expresses his or her interests, and the attorney is to represent those interests, just like an adult. When a child's not mature enough to express his or her own preference, the attorney represents the child's best interests as determined by the attorney's best judgment. As I've indicated, this role is discharged daily in hundreds of cases in the juvenile court where children are routinely granted counsel. And I would ask the committee in deliberating on this bill, why is it that children have counsel in juvenile court where they can be removed from parents' homes, guardians' homes, but they are not granted, or at least they don't have the right to counsel in circuit court, when they can be removed from a third party's home, a grandparent's home, or a parent's home, depending upon the proceeding under 109.119. It's also been suggested that we don't need a child's attorney. We have mom's attorney, we have dad's attorney, we have a grandparent's attorney. Why do we need someone else to mess up the pot? Well, a child's attorney is not superfluous. It is different from a birth parent's attorney, different from a grandparent's attorney, different from a custody evaluator, assuming that one's appointed. And in not every case is there a custody evaluator. The role of a third party's attorney in a custody battle is to win. Plain and simple. Same thing for a parent's attorney. That's what I do when I'm representing a parent. That's what I do when I'm representing a third party. The best interest of the child is important, but it's secondary to my client's interest in prevailing in the custody battle. I'm concerned about winning, as any attorney should be in representing a parent or a third party. The third party's attorney may focus on the birth parent's deficits. The parent's attorney may focus on the primacy of the relationship. There's a lot of smoke and fire, but in the end, the best interest of the child often gets lost in the sauce. And this is not covered adequately by a custody evaluator who may or may not be called to testify. Custody evaluator is a licensed clinical social worker or a psychologist, not a lawyer. They can't present evidence, they can't call witnesses, they can't question the parties, and they can't advocate the child's perspective. In many cases, the child's attorney will have a mediating influence, and Ms. McFarland can also talk to that, avoiding a painful and costly court battle. When the parties know the child's position from an objective source, they are more likely to defer to it. When it is appropriate to transition a child from a third party's home to a parent's home, the attorney can help plan and implement the transition and be available should problems arise. When I've represented a child, in more than half the cases, they have resulted in an agreement and avoided court battles. And that's because, again, A parent's attorney and a third party's attorney is much more likely to defer to an objective third party when they know that it's coming straight from the child.
Okay, and I see here on the testimony the last sections are fiscal implications and proposed amendments. You already talked about the proposed amendments. If you'd be willing to just kind of skip the fiscal, we have it here, which you've already dealt with some.
Thanks, Senator. On the fiscal implications, there ought to be no fiscal implications to the state. The only requirement that I am asking the Judicial Department to do is for the presiding judge in each district, and many districts already have that, is to develop a list in conjunction with the Bar, the Access to Justice Committee, or the local Bar Association of volunteers, attorneys who would agree to serve pro bono or at modest means at the request of the court. And this is already done in most counties, and I think that is a good and proper suggestion for the Judicial Department. Other than that, there is no funding of attorneys required by this statute. Again, I hope that the committee moves forward on the bill in general, but at least at minimum on the proposed amendment number 2, clarifying the discretion of the court. And thank you for your time. I'm ready to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Did you have one, counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Kramer. So what we're saying here is that if a child in a domestic, I guess, is a custody issue, will have an attorney if his parents or guardian can pay for it or someone volunteers. Is that the case for nothing?
Senator Burdick and Mr. Taylor, step one, we have a proceeding. It involves custody. There's a psychological parent relationship, which means there's a caregiver involved. Step two, there is a request. Step three, we try to find pro bono counsel. If not, we try to find modest means counsel. And then at the end of the day, if we can't find that, yes, the court can appoint an attorney and charge parties for the attorney, unless, according to the amendment, the court finds that the parties are unable to afford that.
Then in that case, there would be no attorney.
In that case, there would be no attorney.
So arguably, it could be said that one's ability to pay would be dependent upon whether the child gets counsel or not.
Senator Burdick and Mr. Taylor, that is a concern about creating a system by which some children will have attorneys and some don't. I would hope that through the Judicial Department and the Bar Association that we could get every child who needs counsel volunteer a volunteer attorney.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one more question, Mr. Kramer. But if no one volunteers, then the person will not get an attorney?
If the judge finds that neither the third party, usually the caregiver, and more often than not someone who has deeper financial resources than the birth parent, so the court would have to find that neither parent can provide funds for counsel, be it modest means or otherwise.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one further question, if I could. So if no one volunteers and the parties can't afford to pay, then there will be no counsel appointed for the child.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. If you, Ms. McFarland, if you could keep your remarks as short as possible, we're on a tight time frame today. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, I will keep my remarks short. I have submitted written testimony to you, and so much of which has been covered by Mr. Kramer, and I won't repeat that. In my written testimony, you will find a chart of all of the statutes of other states which provide for the appointment of an attorney, or sometimes called a guardian ad litem, for the child in domestic relations cases. As you can see, that's 49 out of 50 states provide this. We already provide for attorneys for children in domestic relations cases that are covered under Chapter 107 and have been doing so for a number of years. I would also point out that in 21 of the 49 states, the government may pay some of the time or all of the time for the costs of counsel. I do believe, however, that in Oregon we have sufficient numbers of attorneys who are willing to volunteer pro bono to represent children in these cases. The experience in Multnomah County, where we have a panel of 40 attorneys who volunteer for these cases, is that that fees have only been assessed in 5% of the cases, and of course that assessment doesn't mean that those attorneys have actually collected those fees. So I believe that with the if judges will recruit, and I know that many judges now will just sort of reach out and ask an attorney to serve pro bono, but I think if they recruited, they would have a panel in every county in the state who would be willing to serve pro bono in these cases, and that it is not necessary for at this time for the state to pay for those. Juvenile Rights Project does not represent children in domestic relations or third-party custody cases. We represent children exclusively in juvenile court. However, we do get involved in making referrals to the judges in the counties for appointment of counsel for children. And how that happens is that we have a helpline, and we get many calls from children who are alleging allegations of abuse and neglect from their custodial placement, and who are indicating that they have another parent, a non-custodial parent that they would like to live with, or in the case of this bill, a third party, usually a grandparent, who they would like to live with. And for the case of children who have another parent, we can ask for an attorney to be appointed in a domestic relations matter. And then we have some assurance that the issue of abuse and neglect that the child has raised is going to be investigated and is going to be looked into, and steps are going to be taken to assure the safety of that child. If we don't have that option, we then must look to filing a petition in juvenile court, which we do several dozen times a year because we don't have that option. And the case of third-party custody is one of those cases right now where we don't have that option. So the appointment of counsel for children in these kind of cases saves the state money. It diverts children from the dependency court and arena, which is very costly, and it is important for children that they are able to have a representative for their rights in these cases. In the written testimony, there's a proposed amendment. We're withdrawing that amendment at this time in favor of discussing that issue in the interim. That's also an important issue because many of the calls that we get that end up in juvenile court petitions do that because there's no pending matter in domestic relations, which allows the court to appoint an attorney, thus diverting the case from juvenile court. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. In your chart here, it looks like you incorporated under the Oregon section of this chart, the comparative chart, what the bill would do. Is that correct? Or is that?
No, this is what the current law, but only for cases under 107, does.
Under 107, which is
dissolution, divorce, and custody.
So basically, a child can already get a lawyer if the child requests one?
That's correct, Your Honor. Chair Burdick.
I've been waiting all session for somebody to do that. So. Okay. And how old do they have to be to have standing to make a request like that?
Chair Burdick, there's no age limit or requirement. Very often how these appointments happen in my experience is that either the child writes a letter to the judge asking for an attorney or some other person who's concerned about the welfare of the child, such as a grandparent, will write a letter to the judge in the divorce case asking for appointment. Sometimes one of the parents will ask for an appointment for the child in the case. So it's kind of a variety of ways that they actually get appointed.
Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Now let's have Paul Sossi and Sybil Hebb. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Soucy, and I am an attorney. I'm appearing on today on behalf of the Executive Committee, the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, in opposition to this bill. The Family Law Section is a section of approximately 1,000 attorneys that practice family law that are members of the State Bar. I personally have been a private lawyer in the state since 1979, over 26 years. I do practice family law. That is my area of expertise. I have a private office here in Salem, and I practice in the Willamette Valley. The Executive Committee of the Family Law Section opposes this bill. And to understand where we're coming from, perhaps it would be appropriate to explain the three occasions that custody is before the court, where the judge has to decide who is going to have this child. The first one is a divorce case. The second one is paternity case, meaning unmarried biological parents. And the third situation is the one that's presented by this bill, and that is someone says, a non-biological person, not related to the child, says, I should be the parent. That may be a grandparent, it may be a step-parent, it may be somebody else, but that person says, this child should be placed in my care, and I should raise this child rather than the biological parent. We have in place now a procedure, ORS 107.425, pursuant to which the court, in any of these three proceedings, can do a couple of things. One, it can appoint a custody evaluator. Usually it's going to be a mental health care professional whose job it is to interview the child, find out what the child wants, the parents, friends, neighbors, school teachers, et cetera, and then make a recommendation to the court as to what's in this child's best interest. That statute also provides that the court may, at the court's option, decide to appoint an attorney for the child. It is discretionary for the court. However, there is a mandatory provision. That current statute says the court is required to appoint an attorney for the child if the child asks for one. So now we have this Senate bill that asks that you carve out something we believe is special in the psychological parent statute. Why is it that it's mandatory in a psychological parent case that a court appointed an attorney for the child when it's not mandatory unless the child asks in a divorce situation or a paternity situation? Why is this situation create some greater right? There is a question about whether in some people's minds, not in mine, about whether ORS 107.425 applies in the psychological parent venue just because of the numbering of the statutes. Mr. Kramer has suggested as a Second Amendment, just a short one little line that says, yeah, we're going to clarify this. This 107.425 does apply in psychological parent statutes. The Executive Committee of the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section is all in favor of that if it resolves the problem. But as far as making it mandatory, we have major concerns. One of the concerns we have is that because you have two statutes now that create an attorney, maybe this is some super functionary. How does the attorney do its job? Is he making a recommendation to the court the way a custody evaluator is after interviewing all the parties, including the children? Or is he being a really, truly an attorney where you're going to call witnesses and testify? Mr. Kramer said during his comments that if the child's young enough, and it'll be up to the attorney then to make a decision what's in the child's best interest. Well, that's what a custody evaluator does at this point. If an attorney is appointed and says, I've decided that I know what's in the child's best interest and I'm going to explain it to you, Judge, well, then do I, as the mother's attorney, get a chance to cross-examine that attorney to find out what the basis of that opinion was? What did you learn from the child that caused you to take this position? Normally, I would get to cross-examine the expert witness, the evaluator, and that's the whole reason that we have that system in place. But perhaps I'm denied that because of an attorney-client privilege. One of the things that occurs with this statute is that you create rights in a child greater because there's a third party asking for custody than a divorcing child does. In the 70s, there was a movie called Kramer and Kramer. Excuse the front of this bill. But in that bill, the child sued the parents and said, I don't want to be your child anymore. And had its own attorney and went through that process. This is essentially what you have going now if you make it mandatory in a third-party custody request for the child to have an attorney. Mr. Kramer indicated that of the 17 cases he's been involved in, they've not appointed an attorney. Well, the judge has the discretion right now to do it. Clearly, that judge, knowing the facts of the case, decided that that child's interests were adequately represented by the counsel that were there. I have on two occasions been appointed as an attorney for a child, not in a psychological parent case. The facts were essentially the same in both situations. I believe that the judge felt that the parent who should prevail had an attorney that was inadequate. And so by appointing me to represent the child, the judge knew that I would align myself with the parent who was the best parent, thereby buttressing a weak attorney. Since the court already has the authority to do that, in fact, it's already mandatory if the child requests, why do we then need this additional statute? My written comments talk about other concerns as well, including all of a sudden we have a statute that allows me to assess an attorney fee against you for my child. Talk about taxation without representation. I'm having to pay the person who represented my child against me. And it creates a panoply of problems, all very basic, all that are already dealt with by existing statutes. Mr. Kramer indicated his belief that an attorney for a child may be better able to step in and mediate a solution, resolve something between two parents. We already have mandatory mediation in every county in the state. If the third-party counsel needs to be there to help coordinate parenting schedules, we already have a process by statute now that allows the court to appoint what's called a parenting coordinator, a person who acts somewhat on the judge's behalf to step in and play referee on do I pick them up at 7 or do I pick them up at 5 o'clock, those situations. So what we're doing here is we're creating a situation where we already have statutes that do these. And to take a look at the fact that other states have statutes that say we appoint a guardian for the child, I think if you take a look at those statutes, most of those are guardian ad litems, and what they do is they go in and perform the function that our custody evaluators do. Again, they get to ask what the child wants, get that information, and pass it to the judge through testimony where they're subject to cross-examine. I have other comments in my written materials, which I won't go through. You indicate time is short, but I would like to make clear that the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section does oppose this bill. We do not oppose the Second Amendment, Mr. Kramer has suggested, because that clarifies that the existing statutory framework does apply in the situations.
Thank you.
I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the testimony that's been handed in and what Ms. Hebb is going to be testifying to, what I haven't heard from anyone at this point is where the CASA fits into this. I thought the CASA was really what I'm hearing is one of the advocates really for the child that steps up and acts for the child. So not that you need to respond to that, Ms. Hebb, you may want to put that into your testimony now, because it seems to me that we're basically creating another, what I'm going to call a dual system.
Senator Pazansky, I'll let Ms. Hebb respond to that.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll just say, with the exception that the CASA doesn't have the legal training that an attorney has.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Budik, sir, the statutory precedent exists in Oregon enabling the court to assign third-party attorney fees to litigants, or is this kind of new ground we're plowing here?
Senator Whitsitt, that provision is already in ORS 107.425. If the court decides that it wants to assess attorney fees, it can. We already have it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hebb, you're on.
Thank you, Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb, for the record, for the Oregon Law Center. I'll keep my comments brief in the interest of time. I just want to echo the support for the Dash 2 amendments to the extent that there is any confusion or lack of clarity about whether or not the provisions of 107.425 apply to third-party psychological parent proceedings, and we think it should be resolved, because clearly it may be the right thing in certain circumstances or in certain cases for or an attorney to be appointed to represent the interests of a child. We have no objection to that, and we think that it should be a discretionary call for the judge to make. And in my experience as a former practicing family law attorney, judges were making those appointments when they so felt it was appropriate. The concern that we have is with respect to any mandatory requirement that attorneys be appointed, and we feel that the language of the bill and even the language of the amendment doesn't adequately take into account the fact that in many, many cases, parties are simply unable to afford attorneys for themselves, much less for their children, and many of them are also unable to afford custody evaluators. Senator Pozanski, to address your question about the availability of CASA volunteers, it's my understanding and my experience, CASA volunteers are primarily appointed in juvenile dependency proceedings, and they are not appointed except rarely, and I believe it's not provided for within the guidelines. They're not appointed in non-juvenile dependency cases. And I invite any correction, but my experience has never been that CASAs have been appointed in domestic relations proceedings. And they provide an evaluation of the needs of the child and act to speak sort of for the child's best interests. They perform a very valuable service, and would that we had a process like that in all proceedings. But the fact is that we don't, and I wanted to provide or sort of bring the court's or the committee's attention to the fact that a significant percentage of people going through custody proceedings or any court proceeding are unrepresented, and I went to look at the 2000 State of Access to Justice Legal Needs Assessment that was funded by the State Bar and by the Judicial Department as well as by the Governor's Office. And the statistics that they found in that 2000 study were that more than 250,000 otherwise eligible applicants for legal aid were turned away due to lack of resources in a year, and of the lower income people going through the process, they are represented by attorneys less than 18% of the time, and so there's a huge bulk of people who just don't have the access, and for those reasons we're very concerned about having the court be required to appoint attorneys without taking that reality into consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 966, and we will show for the record that we are now convened as a full committee of Senate Judiciary, and we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 287, now that we have Senator Walker on board here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 287 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. Permits a victim statement made out of court to be used in court if the party to the court proceedings, usually a defendant in the criminal trial, engaged in wrongdoing that caused the person making the statement to be unavailable. We have before us the -5 and -6 amendments. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you want to take a look at them, I will tell you the one word difference between the two. And one word can mean a lot. On line 2, after it says reliable in one, and the other one it does not. In the -6, it says a reliable statement. In the -5, it says a statement. And chairmen of the committee, we have Tom Reiniger, Tim Sylvester, Eric Wasserman, Ann Muncy, and Pete Gartland, all of whom may want to have something to say about this. Actually, there are two parties. Maybe it's Ann Muncy and Tom Reiniger and Tim Sylvester that probably should come up and discuss what the significance of the word reliable means.
Appreciate that. Could you come up, Mr.
Madam Chair, I don't have the amendments.
They were just handed out. They're probably right on top of your...
I have them now. Thank you. I don't see them in the stack. Oh, here they are. They're in the stack of other stuff. I'm going to hand that back to them.
We have our whole
team on board here to try to tell us the difference between reliable and absence of reliable. Welcome, Miss. Who wants to start here?
Well, we let proponents to the reliable start.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division, At our last hearing on this, at the suggestion of the chair, we recessed and formed a committee to hammer out some sort of acceptable compromise to among all the parties involved, and we did that last week, and we ended up with two proposals. And as it was mentioned, the only difference between the two proposals is, as I understand it, no one has any problem with any of the other language. The only difference between the two proposals is that the dash 5 does not contain the word reliable. The dash 6, which is the one that is being supported by the defense bar, adds the word reliable between A and statement, both in paragraph F and paragraph G. And from our standpoint, and Eric Lossman is here from the Department of Justice, and I think he can explain our opposition to the use of the addition of the word reliable, and I'll hand it off to him.
Chair Burdick, Eric Wassman, and I'm also with the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice. We see the exception that we're asking this body to enact here as being one that is based not necessarily, as many other hearsay exceptions are, on the concept that the statements are inherently reliable, but this rule we see as being based on the idea of fairness and equity. It is essentially that when the person against whom the statement would be offered has caused the declarant to be unavailable through criminal conduct or other wrongful conduct, that person should not claim the benefit of the wrongful conduct by excluding hearsay statements. And because the exception is based on rules of fairness and equity, we don't see that this committee would really be accomplishing anything significant here if it added the word reliability into that rule and essentially create a super requirement over and above the equity or fairness conditions that form the basis of the rule. And I want to point out here in the context of the evidence code that there actually are other hearsay exceptions that capture the reliability concept that has been suggested to you. Rules 803 subsection 28 and 804 3F, which we commonly know as the residual hearsay exceptions, are based primarily on the idea that the hearsay statements, which may not fall into some other hearsay exception that's very specific, have circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness that are equivalent to those found throughout the evidence code, and for that reason, essentially for their reliability, those statements should come in. But we here are suggesting a new rule based upon the idea of equity and fairness. And we see that there are still going to be protections in place for the person against whom these statements would be offered. Those protections would exist both in the rules themselves, in the court's determination that the statement, first of all, is relevant under 401, that relevance is not outweighed by the risk of undue prejudice under Rule 403, and also guarantees that exist outside of the evidence code, because the Sixth Amendment will not go away. Article 1, Section 11's confrontation right will not go away. And at some future point, although the courts have given us no suggestion that they think reliability is required for forfeiture by wrongdoing rule as we understand it presently, if at some future point they decide that reliability is required, the courts will simply impose it and limit the rule accordingly. But we see no reason for the legislature to do that at this stage because the courts have given no suggestion that they think that is required. So what we're asking is that this body enact a rule based on equity and fairness, and I think, frankly, that if the court were to impose the reliability requirement that's been suggested, that this committee's work might simply just get swallowed up into the existing residual hearsay exceptions, which honestly have been pretty much a locked gate to the admission of hearsay declarations.
Thank you. If the word reliable stayed in, would that require some Would it require motions, or would it require some kind of proceeding for the judge to determine what was and wasn't reliable, or would that be determined in the course of the trial?
Chair Burdick, this could occur either through pretrial motions or during hearing in the course of the trial. It would be probably a preliminary determination by the court under Rule 104. The court is also going to have to make a determination, even under the language we're both suggesting here, that the wrongdoing of the person against whom the evidence is being offered is the reason why the declarant is unavailable.
Because wouldn't, like as you said, wouldn't the reliability, I mean, wouldn't that go right to the heart of the facts that are being presented in the trial? I mean, it would be judged under the standards of the trial as the trial unfolded?
Chair Burdick, I'm not quite sure I'm getting the question there.
I mean, obviously anybody could make up anything they want and say it, but that would be subject to the jury findings and the regular analysis that goes on in a trial.
Chair Burdick, if I understand you correctly, of course the jury will weigh the reliability of the statement in deciding what weight to give it in its factual determinations on the main issues in the case, yes.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you. Now the other side. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Muncy, and I represent the Office of Public Defense Services. I'd first like to acknowledge the tremendous amount of thought and work that both Tim Sylvester and Professor Leininger have put into this bill. I became involved with this bill very late in the process, and I can see that those who have come before me have done an excellent job. My only concern has to do with the reliability of the evidence that will be admitted under this provision. The key to Senate Bill 287 is that it's going to become part of the evidence code. The evidence code is designed to ensure that only proper evidence, the type of evidence that's going to get at the truth, is admitted in a trial. It prevents a person from being tried based on gossip, rumor, lies, and speculation. Now, the hearsay exceptions, most of them have an inherent reliability built into them, and that's the purpose of the hearsay exceptions, is there's categories of evidence that we recognize have inherent reliability in them, such as excited utterance. When somebody is startled and blurts something out, they're probably going to be blurting out the truth, or a statement made for purposes of medical diagnosis. A person's not going to lie to their doctor when their own health is involved. So most of the hearsay exceptions have, by their very nature, are reliable, and that's why we admit them at trial. Now, there are a few more practical hearsay exceptions that have been admitted because of the need for the evidence. There's the domestic violence hearsay exception, which I believe has been addressed before, and there's the active abuse hearsay exception for abuse against children or elderly people. Now, both of those don't necessarily have their own indicia of reliability automatically built in. So prior legislators who have enacted those exceptions have put in an explicit reliability requirement. So this continues to ensure that the type of evidence that comes into a trial is in fact reliable. And in this case, the purpose of putting the forfeiture provision into the evidence code is essentially to replace the evidence that the court has been denied. If a party causes a witness to be unavailable, that party has deprived the court of that witness's testimony. So we need to replace that testimony with something. And so we're saying, okay, we're going to let hearsay evidence in this case, to replace the evidence that has been taken away. But we still want that evidence to be reliable. I mean, there's no reason to try a person on unreliable evidence. Even if somebody has committed a wrongdoing by preventing a person from testifying, there's still no reason to convict them of something they didn't do. I mean, that's not what trials are about. So that's the reason that it's appropriate to have the forfeiture provision in the evidence code, but it's also appropriate to make a reliability requirement. I mean, judges, again, this type of evidence is only going to come in after an OEC 104 hearing at which the judge has determined if the various requirements of the hearsay rule are met. And by making reliability one of those requirements, the judge is just doing what the judge always does, making sure that the evidence that goes to the fact finder is in fact reliable. I mean, it doesn't make sense to admit unreliable evidence into a trial that's designed to get at the truth.
So what you're saying, you mentioned a couple of other places where the reliability, is the actual word reliable used in those other cases?
In those two other hearsay exceptions, it's required an indicia of reliability, and they've actually listed out factors to be considered in determining whether the statement has indicia of reliability. We're trying to make this a little more simple by just requiring the evidence to be reliable. But they'd be looking to similar factors to make that determination. And as I said, you know, judges in deciding whether hearsay exception comes in are always determining, making sure that the evidence is reliable before it's admitted to the jury. That's the purpose of the evidence code. That's the purpose of the hearsay rules. And so we're just asking that this fit right in with all the rest of the hearsay rules with that requirement.
Okay. Did you have a question?
Madam Chair, before I do, I want to hear what Ms. Langinger says, and then I've got stuff for the panels from both sides.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. First, I wanted to commend all the participants, and in particular Ms. Munsey, whose influence on this bill is not only reflected in the reliability proposal, but also in three or four other areas where all of us were glad to adopt her changes. She's really made an important impact on the bill. I would oppose...
You identify yourself for the...
Oh, excuse me, ma'am, or Chair. My name is Tom Leininger. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon Law School, speaking today on my own behalf. I only wanted to mention points that haven't been mentioned before. I do agree with what the spokespeople from the Department of Justice had to say. I think the word reliability, standing alone, does create some problems. First of all, Ms. Munsey pointed out that typically in the evidence code, the word reliability is not mentioned in the hearsay exception. That's because the judge necessarily, as part of the final determination of whether probative value is substantially outweighed by prejudicial effect, that calculation almost always addresses concerns about unreliability. There are only a few times where reliability appears in the evidence code, and there it's a much more particularized inquiry with very specific factors to look to. Where we lack those factors, we risk that the term will be ambiguous and will lead to reduced predictability of outcomes at trial, which makes it harder for parties to know whether to go to trial. And I think that were we to include a reliability requirement, it would be more typical to include it with a list of those criteria that make evidence reliable. Standing alone, it creates ambiguity. I did want to point out that importing the reliability criterion would distinguish our version of this rule from most other states that have adopted this rule. Virtually all of them, except for California, that have adopted this rule, have left out the term reliability. I don't have anything more to add to what's been said.
So what you're saying is that the concept of reliability is part of what's factored in the balancing between probative value and prejudicial value under the existing evidence code?
I believe that's true.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think that the short answer may be that in order for evidence to come in at all, and this sort of statement has to meet all of the other rules for admissibility under the evidence code, including a determination of relevance. If the evidence is not sufficiently reliable, the court will keep it out on relevance grounds. If it has minimal relevance, but the danger of unfair prejudice is there, the court will keep it out under OEC 403. What this rule will require is some sort of enhanced showing of reliability, something beyond what is required for any other piece of evidence. And from our standpoint, to the extent that there is a substantial question of reliability above and beyond the determination of relevance, that is what a defense counsel is for, to present contrary evidence and then to make argument to the jurors why they should discount that evidence as unreliable. And ultimately, of course, it's going to be up to the jury to make the determination of reliability. What adding the word reliable here is actually to keep evidence away from the jury and not allow the jurors to consider evidence that otherwise would meet all the other rules for admission under the evidence code.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair Burdick, if I might add one additional comment.
Ms. Muncy mentioned that many of the other hearsay exceptions are based on the legislature's determination of their inherent reliability and then contrasted what we're suggesting here. I want to point out not all of the other hearsay exceptions are based on a judgment of inherent reliability. And one notable difference is the hearsay exception for admissions of a party opponent. That really, like this forfeiture by wrongdoing provision, is a rule based on fairness and equity. There is no super requirement of reliability on those statements.
Can you tell us how that rule works?
Essentially, in a criminal case, which I'm most experienced with, the admissions of the criminal defendant are admissible if offered against him or her.
Party opponent.
Thank you. Senator Pazansky.
Yeah, thank you. I guess we're on a follow-up. This is a great segue because I was part of that work group, and when I walked out, I had some other things happening, but the Dash 5s is basically where we were. Then the reliable part came in. Ms. Guy gave me a heads-up this morning. I asked her to give me what she was referring to as to the different areas, and she was kind enough to take some stuff out of the evidence code, and there's two areas. One is the DV exception. The other appears to be where we're dealing with abuse, apparently in the elder area. And I think what Eric's brought up is the point of what is the fairness. I mean, to me, you have reliability always going to be balanced as to whether or not it's relevant, etc. The statutes where there is this phrase, because it's not the word reliability by itself, it's indicia of reliability, and then they give some framework. But it really seems to me that what we're looking at, and this is the part that I'm having some difficulty with, if you go with that word in the Dash 6, it appears to me it's going to take it to another level than where it normally would be as a party opponent, because in most cases you're basically looking at either words that have been used by the defendant and the party opponent, something that you can incriminate or that's incriminating, and these are conducts. This is actual action of where somebody may have done something to cause them to not be there. So I guess really for either side of the issue, can you walk us through and give us some examples of what you think are the type of statements where you think the reliability would be necessary to take it to that next level, and where it would be reasonable to have that as compared to what the court currently and always has been doing in balancing, so we can just kind of get a snapshot of what you think is something that would not be reliable versus something that would be reliable.
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, I have a couple of things I wanted to point out. First of all, the statements of the party opponent, first of all, that's not actually a hearsay exception. It is defined as not being hearsay, so there's a bit of a conceptual difference behind it. And also, I mean, there's an assumption that people aren't going to make statements against their own interests and, you know, or make admissions unless they're really true. And also, finally, because it's a party opponent, that party is present to explain, you know, hearsay is admitted, is present at the trial to explain his statement, say that's not really what I meant, or explain any misunderstandings. And so it's in a different category than the general hearsay exceptions, and then this would be. So that's one point. Another point is, I don't believe this is like a heightened standard of reliability for this specific hearsay exception. As I said before, all of the hearsay exceptions contain their own inherent guarantees of trustworthiness, and the ones that don't, the past legislatures have seen fit to just insert that requirement in. Now, in terms of specific examples, I thought of the case where you have a mother-in-law, she tells her neighbor, I think the defendant is beating up my daughter. I think he might be taking drugs. And then the defendant is angry about that, says, you know, you've never liked me from the very beginning since I married your daughter. If you testify to these lies and, you know, put me in jail for something I didn't do, I'll kill you. So then, of course, she's scared. She doesn't testify. Defendants caused it. But the problem is there's no basis of knowledge for her statement. You try to bring in the neighbor to say, mother-in-law said that defendant is beating up her, you know, beating up her daughter. There's no basis of knowledge. I mean, that could just be her own idea. There's nothing to guarantee that there's any truth in that statement. I mean, normally, if she were there as a witness to testify, we'd be asking, well, how do you know this? Maybe it's just come out of her head. Maybe she's just suspicious. There's there's nothing to guarantee that reliability.
Yeah, but wouldn't that flunk on other grounds, like prejudice, double hearsay or triple hearsay, and also being prejudicial without being probative since she had no first-hand knowledge? I don't understand why that wouldn't flunk out on other grounds.
Well, I guess that's what I'm concerned about, is that OEC 403 is fairly far down the process. I mean, and because other times we have not just left the hearsay exceptions and the reliability requirement to 403. I mean, if 403 just took care of those situations, then we wouldn't have needed to put indicia of reliability into the domestic violence exception. We wouldn't have needed to put it in to the acts of abuse exception. If 403 just took care of everything all the time and, you know, ensured that evidence admitted would be reliable, we wouldn't have needed to make that requirement. But we do, because that's what the hearsay rules are about. The hearsay rules are about reliability. We only want reliable evidence admitted at trial. We don't want lies and speculation to go to the jury. That's the judge's function as a gatekeeping. The judge has a gatekeeping function to make sure that what goes to the fact finder is reliable. That's what his role has always been. That's what his role is in admitting every single hearsay exception. And I think it's appropriate to have that in this one. It's just no different than any other hearsay exception.
I guess I give the state opponents to dash six. I mean, Why do we have the reliability, the indicia of reliability in these other two areas, and why wouldn't that be applicable here as to an example? I mean, I'm just want to put some stuff on the record so we have something here that the courts will be looking at when this issue comes up.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senator Brzezinski, the two circumstances in which there is an enhanced requirement, there is a showing of enhanced reliability that is required, are very specific situations, particularly where you are dealing with children who have been sexually abused, and so reliability may be questionable. In addition, you are dealing with a situation where the evidence itself doesn't really fall within any other hearsay exception. These are 803 18AB, for example, which is, I think, one of the ones they were referring to. That is evidence that otherwise doesn't fit within any sort of theory of admissibility, and so the legislature created a special rule of evidence that allows this evidence in, and because of constitutional concerns, they added this requirement that there be a showing of enhanced reliability. I think the purpose for those showings of enhanced reliability were driven by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Ohio versus Roberts, is that it, in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that when you're dealing with non-traditional hearsay exceptions, there has to be a showing of indicia of reliability. Now, that is to be distinguished from the one that we are talking about today, because the U.S. Supreme Court in Crawford recognized this forfeiture by wrongdoing exception as being based on a common law exception that goes back many, many years, and the common law exception way back then did not require a showing of enhanced reliability, and the court in Crawford also didn't suggest that there would be a need for enhanced showing of reliability for this particular exception. And so I think the short answer is that those particular rules require that because it's been determined or it's been feared that that showing was required by the Constitution, and here we don't have that requirement.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I just had one. Professor Leininger, isn't the reliability standard more a standard for the court to decide?
It has been. I really appreciate Mr. Sylvester's last explanation. That was the point I was raising my hand to make. Any state that innovated a non-traditional hearsay exception in the 80s and 90s had to include the term indicia of reliability, because Roberts only applied to non-firmly rooted hearsay exceptions for the reliability analysis, and Roberts has basically been overruled in many respects in 2004. So I think you're right. That has traditionally been the province of the courts, and I think the legislatures wanted to give some guidance in the hearsay code to what, or the hearsay rules to what the party should expect to have to talk about for that determination. But as Mr. Sylvester pointed out, where you have forfeiture by wrongdoing, the present Supreme Court guidance is that the courts are not obligated to weigh reliability as part of the constitutional analysis. They still may under the 403 prejudice versus probative value. Does that answer your question,
yes,
Senator?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the next five amendments to Senate Bill 287.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 287. Is there a discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruzanski.
I think I'm going to put on the record. Again, I want to thank everyone that's worked on this problem. When it came in, if you remember when we first saw the bill, it had a lot of, let's say, issues from the proponents and the opponents as to what was going to be best. What I see in the dash 5 really does seem to capture what I'm going to consider the an Oregon rule as it applies to what has happened around the state, the states, and I think it's a fair one and it's very concise and lays out what we're going to allow in these particular areas. But I also think that the proponents to the dash 5s have articulated, in my opinion, based on what I've heard today, that this is the way that we should go, that we should not saddle a burden with the other word, the dash 6, the reliable, based on what is being utilized in the same area of law in other parts of the state, what's required under the U.S. Supreme Court's review, as well as what the common law, which this is all based on, provides for. Clearly, if we see an issue in the future, we can always come back and address it at that time. But I feel comfortable with going with the dash fives at this point, letting the opponents to the dash fives understand that if we see that this is not being, let's say, captured in the way I think this committee believes it will, then we should look at this in the future.
Thank you. And as chair of the committee, I'd like to also add that I believe I was persuaded by the comments by you all that the concept of reliability is already inherent in the evidence code and will continue to be a factor in the admission of this kind of evidence, and that is why I am supporting the dash 5 amendments, and we surely will revisit this. This is a relatively new area of law. We will revisit it if it gets to be if the interpretation is otherwise, and but I believe from the statements that were given we're on firm ground here. So, Member Wissett, did you have a comment?
I just have a basic resistance to admission of hearsay evidence, and I understand the need for it in this situation, but I am personally more comfortable with the dash 6 with reliable in there, and not being a lawyer, I may not understand all the nuances, but it's just it feels better to me with the reliable in there.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt. Are there other comments from the committee? Senator Whitsitt, is your concern enough to count as an objection, or are you going to support the dash 5 amendment?
I would object to the dash 5. I'd probably support the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Would you take the roll on the dash 5 amendment, please?
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Pruzanski?
Aye.
Senator Wingo? Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Five ayes, one nay.
Senator Starr?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 287 as amended to floor with the new pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 287 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Want to carry this? Senator Pruzanski will carry this, and I would like to particularly request that you give some of your comments on the record on the Senate floor as well as here, because that's what the court looks to first. A special request of the carrier. We're in new territory here.
Yeah. Special request.
Thank you very much. Okay. Should we do 95?
Sure.
We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 95. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 95 comes at the request of Governor Kulongoski for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. You have what the bill does is expands the membership of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission from 9 members to 15 members. What does it will add 6 more members appointed by the 4 new members appointed by the 6 members appointed by the governor, subject to Senate confirmation. You have the -1 amendments in front of you, which says at least one member shall be a practicing criminal defense attorney and at least one member shall be a practicing prosecutor. The -2 amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee, which authorize the commission to develop and implement a plan to reduce the consumption, manufacture, sale, and distribution of illegal drugs, particularly methamphetamines, and developing and implementing a plan, the commission shall consider evidence-based programs. And then it says, it then defines what a drug program is, and as part of this, the commission may enter, may make grants to establish support drug court programs, district attorneys, defense counsel, all to support drug programs, treatment providers for the same reason, probation departments, county corrections facilities, establish a program within the public and private secondary schools intended to educate students about the harmful effects of substance abuse, law enforcement agencies for the purposes of enforcing criminal laws relating to precursor substances and methylsiphenol, methane, and reducing the manufacture of methamphetamines, and evaluate programs receiving grants under this section. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the -3 amendments, which would allow, in addition, the court, state court administrator, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, may use records under this for the purposes of tracking and developing. And I believe there's a note up here that Tim Travis may want to say something as it relates to putting his statement on the record.
Okay, maybe Tim Travis and Craig Prince, if he's here, would like to come up. Are there any questions on this?
I'm Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department, and insofar as the department has resources to support drug courts in Oregon, I'm it. I just wanted to clarify on the -3 amendments. In paragraph 6 on page 2, beginning line 20, we're dealing here with access to substance abuse treatment records. And as I'm sure you know, substance abuse treatment records are the most highly confidential records going. Federal law protects them under 42 USC, and there are very strict rules about how they can and can't be released. I just wanted to clarify that paragraph 6 does not require the court or the state court administrator to deliver to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission records which identify individual drug treatment clients. And that I want to make sure that the lines 27 through 29 are understood to apply not only to other transfers outside of the Criminal Justice Commission, but also apply to transfers to the Criminal Justice Commission. We will be pleased to work with the Criminal Justice Commission in setting up computer programs and sharing data and all this business reports and all that kind of stuff like that. But we cannot send them records which say John Doe or Timothy Travis or any other drug court client did this, that, or the other thing, failed this, that, or the other thing. I understand that the Criminal Justice Commission is interested in developing reports to compare effectiveness of different treatment modalities. And we can do that by creating profiles and creating statistical reports within profile treatment modality A, treatment modality B, treatment modality C. What we cannot do by federal law is provide a list of people who are in A, a list of people who are in B, and a list of people who are in C. So I just wanted to clarify that on the record. And I believe these amendments say that, but they say it in a convoluted way because they refer back to subsection 3, which is on page 1, lines 19 to 24.
Right. And that says that they can't disclose them, the confidential parts. I'm just wondering if it might make sense to, instead of saying records, to say data or something something different than records to make it clear?
Well, Matt, we use the term record all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the term that's used in all of the confidentiality statutes, and the term record has a definition. And so you see on line 19 on page 1, it talks about records that are maintained, records
right.
maintained. So in the interest of consistency, you know how we lawyers are. If we see two different words, we think it must have two different meanings.
Okay, so basically it goes back to those regulations adopted under the 42 U.S. codes. And those regulations are what you're relying on to keep the names and the identifying data out of there.
Absolutely, Senator.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're comfortable that it does the job, then. I'm glad you put that on the record.
Thank you.
Do you have anything to add, Mr. Prinz?
No, Madam Chair, Craig Prinz, I don't, and just wanted to state, obviously we want to follow federal law, too. We just see that there's a need as just to track how different systems are going to be doing. So I think Timothy put it on the record appropriately to make sure that there's no confusion about that.
Okay, I appreciate that. So what you're looking for is all three amendments because they're all separate purposes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, question.
Senator Starr.
These new provisions are not creating a fiscal impact that we need to be concerned about.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, the Dash 2 amendment is going to have that. I mean, I think that in Section 3, it does not have an appropriation yet, but I think that to have grants, there would have to be money to do that. And also, I would need to have someone on my staff to be able to administer that. So I think there would be an impact, but because it's blank, I don't...
Well, if it's... that's an interesting... What do we do, Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Prinz, does this bill need to go to Ways and Means Committee?
I think so. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it would. I don't think there is grants in the general governor's budget to do this. And I think I look at this as an outgrowth of the committee's meetings in Pendleton and the other... meetings you've had and the work you've done in trying to figure out a systemic way to deal with the meth issue, and I think it would, because I think that that's where the discussion would have to be, and Senator Starr's point would have to be argued about and fleshed out about how we would effectuate this.
I think I'm going to hang on to this because of that provision. Rather than sending it down, because we're going to be dealing with a bunch of other meth issues as they come to the committee, I think I will hang on to this. The question is whether we'd want to put council.
Madam Chair, if we are eventually going to move the bill, it would... Well, no, I can get the amendments combined on my own, so the next time the bill comes up, we'll have all four amendments.
Okay, the alternative, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, is to move the bill along with just the Dash 1 amendment, and actually the Dash 3 amendment kind of depends on the Dash 2 amendment.
Correct.
Those are related. So we could actually move, I don't know how much... of a hurry you're in to get it settled, the membership, which is what this bill started out as.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it would be helpful, but I don't think that's a kind of an end of the session thing. So I think we're at the point where we have the vacancies are going to be up for confirmation, and so I don't see a big hurry on that. And so I wouldn't mind waiting for the whole bill if you wish to do that.
Thank you. I've got, I guess, not really questions, but as the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, I guess, you know, obviously there's many of us had conversations about this concept after the Pendleton meetings, and I got some questions why we would do this in the Criminal Justice Commission and not somewhere else like the courts.
And my bigger question, I guess, would be how this concept fits into the entire, I guess, in my opinion, is still undefined meth plan in the building. I don't want to send this bill forward now in this manner, not knowing what else is going to happen in meth. I've raised that concern already in this committee and also in the Commerce Committee that we need to get together, decide what's going to happen in this arena, and get it done, not piecemeal a little bit here, a little bit there, and no one really knows what's going on. I have those concerns. I also am comfortable putting in this bill because I'm opposed to the original bill, and I'm opposed to the Dashwell amendments. So, you know, it would be very, for me personally, I don't think that's the right way to do what the dash twos and threes are attempting to do.
Yeah, I'm leaning to that opinion myself, Senator Beyer. So I'll trade you. I'll hold those out if you'll give me a courtesy vote on the dash one amendment.
You don't need to my vote on
those. If I may make one more clarifying statement. The data transfers and analyses that are talked about in paragraph 6, we are not saying that we have unlimited funds to do any kind of data analysis the Criminal Justice Commission wants done, because we obviously have limitations in our analysts and our time and our computer and like that. So I just want to clarify that we're glad to do them, but it's subject to resources.
No, and I understand. I do see the dash 2 and 3 as going in a different direction than the original bill in the dash 1. So I think what I'd like to do, committee, is hang on to the dash 2 and 3 amendments and keep them in our little meth file that we'll be dealing with, and send this bill along with the dash 1 amendment as a clean bill, if you approve of this dash 1 amendment, Senator Starr.
Well, I continue to have some concerns there as well, and I think that just holding the bill in its present position, and we can deal with moving it as we have greater clarification.
Okay. I want to send Senator Pazansky.
Yeah. If we're just looking at the dash ones, I wonder if we couldn't just have maybe a quick discussion as to it appears that some of the members of the committee are not in agreement that we need to expand the membership, the number, or the qualifications of some of those members. And I'm wondering if we could have a discussion to see if there's something that we should be working on, or is this just a general philosophy of not expanding another commission any greater than it already is.
Senator Beyer, did you want to, because we had the hearing on this, what about a month ago?
Yeah, at least a month ago. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess there's two things for me. The original bill, I don't really see the need to expand. I mean, we already have vacancies on the commission. Expanding the membership is going to make it harder to fill vacancies. This is not a group that just gets around and has coffee and donuts just for something to do. This is a commission that's supposed to work. And it's, as we're finding in all boards and commissions we have in the state, it's more and more difficult to get good people, qualified people who want to serve and do the job that needs to be done. I don't see the need to, you know, greatly expand this commission at this point in time when we've already had, you know, vacancies to deal with on the existing side of the commission. As to the dash ones, where you would require a person to be a criminal defense attorney and a practicing prosecutor, there's nothing that I see in the current law that prohibits membership to be these two groups, or only one of each of these two groups. I think it's redundant to have to state that in that if you have that requirement, you know, just do it. If the governor and the Senate thinks those are people that need to be on the commission, appoint them. You don't need to say it in law. That's my own personal feeling.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. I do want to point out that that's a fairly common thing on some of these commissions where they deal with a subject area to have, you know, a management and a labor or a whatever for balance. And that's what this was intended to do.
Madam Chair,
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I had written that this expands the Criminal Justice Commission from 9 to 11, but in the background information in the staff measure summary, it says it's expanding it from 9 to 15. So I need some clarification on that.
Ms. Krims.
That's 15 right on the bill.
Yeah.
That's 15 on the bill.
Okay. Well, my question is, where did 11 ever come from?
Well, the 11 becomes all those appointed by the governor. And I'm assuming I was not present at the other hearings on this bill, and no one, I would repeat, no one has come to talk to me about the need for this bill. And I'm assuming they want 15 members to make it a larger group in case some people can't make it. But I have the same concern Senator Beyer has. So, Council, we've got a problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I took over this bill just over the weekend, and I had the same questions that you had, Senator Walker, members of the committee, when I looked at the bill. And what it is it's going from 7 to 13 appointed by the governor. There are two also ex officio non-voting members who are there because they are a member of the House and Senate, respectively, and they're appointed by their respective leadership. So that's how we get to 15. There's established the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission consisting of 15 members. The governor shall appoint, so the 7, 13 members. And the president of the Senate shall appoint one state senator as a non-voting member. The Speaker of the House shall appoint one state representative as a non-voting member. That's how we get the numbers. And as I said, I had to have the, I had to sit down and kind of pencil it out myself this morning.
I think this bill is not drawing a huge amount of enthusiasm, and I think we're going to close the work session on it right now. Thank you.
Good choice.
You're welcome, Mr. Vice Chair. Okay, now we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 253.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 253 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee and enacts the Interstate Compact for Juveniles. We have the Dash 1 amendments in front of us that do two things. First off, they create, as it's similarly created, that is currently exists in the Adult Compact. The Interstate Compact for Juvenile Fund is established, a separate and distinct fund from the general fund. And the reason for this is to remove any kind of constitutional ambiguity that may exist in the sense that the legislature can't delegate to anyone else the ability to require us to pay funds. So we would be limited by the money that goes into the account of paying out dues or anything else under the Interstate Compact. And also Section 2, when the Oregon Youth Authority was created in 1995, practically all of the functions that were went with it, before that it was part of DHS, Department of Human Services, the one function that stayed behind, and I don't know if it was intentional at the time, or it was the administration of the Juvenile Compact, which currently exists. I have Mr. Masters, who was here at our last hearing. He is available by speakerphone if we have questions, and he's there with Mr. Montjoy, who was with the CSG Council of State Governments, but those are the Dash 1 amendments to the bill.
Okay, and as I understand it, by moving it over to the Youth Authority, you're also moving over the money to manage it. And it might require a Ways and Means referral?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. The function now is currently with DHS. It will go to the Oregon Youth Authority. That would mean that there would have to be a transfer of funds of approximately $200,000 from one agency to the other to handle administration.
Okay. We had our hearing on this about... What do your notes say, Senator Walker?
I know. I was just looking at them, Madam Chair.
There it is.
228.05. I have three pages of notes.
All right. Okay. So the Dash 1 amendment definitely makes sense since that's where it's located. But I think even though this doesn't have a subsequent referral, if we move this bill, I think we need to move it to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, that would be the appropriate place for the transfer of funds from one agency to another should they decide to do so.
Okay. Senator Starr, would you have an opinion on the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, I would move those.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 253. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. My notes, all from the 28th of February when we first heard this bill, indicate that I didn't like it then.
Yeah, he didn't.
I don't see how the Dash 1s changed that much for me personally. The $200,000 number, I don't see it in my notes, but I recall that that was the amount that there would be cost to do with this new bill, to do the same thing we've been doing for, it seemed like about $30,000, if I remember right. So I'd like to have clarification on that amount, on those amounts. Also, I have written down that it has to pass 35 states to take effect. There are, it has passed 22. It is introduced into 10. Currently, that is 32 max if all passed it. So at best case scenario, it can't happen this year. And my thought was, let's wait and see what happens in someplace else, so we can always come in at a later date if we like what they have done.
Okay. Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer is correct. There is an additional expense for the administration of the compact. The $200,000 we're talking about is a transfer of funds from one agency to another. I'm not sure if the additional cost for administration would be $30,000 or whatever, but there is an additional cost there. But there's also the requirement, if we do adopt amendments and send the bill forward, of the funds having to be transferred from one agency to another for the administration of the compact as opposed to the administration of the advisory committee.
And so what we don't know is how much more the compact costs than the advisory committee. Do you know how much money is already existing, or would it require an additional appropriation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it will require an additional appropriation because it's not in anyone's budget right now.
Hmm.
Senator Byers pointed out a salient point, and that is that the compact takes effect in 35 states. Adopt it, so it's somewhat speculative as to when those administration costs as it relates to the advisory committee would take place.
Mm-hmm.
What would not be speculative would be the fact that if the bill were adopted, with the authority being transferred from the DHS to the Oregon Youth Authority, that would be a responsibility that would take effect upon passage, so those funds would have to be transferred regardless of when the compact takes effect.
Madam Chair, I guess I would, by that explanation, I may withdraw my objection to the Dash 1 amendments, but my objection to the bill still remains.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only other thing I'd add, I mean, it seems to me that what we're going to do is we're going to request that Ways and Means looks at the shifting of the responsibility from DHS to the Youth Authority. The only benefit, and it is a big benefit, if and when the compact is adopted by 35 states. Those states are going to be the ones that actually set up the rules and make the rules. And we would want to, I think, if we're going to be an active participant, want to have Oregon's voices heard at that time. But it's only, who knows how quickly this is going to happen. I know they had a big push. I went back for that presentation, I guess it was a year, about 18 months back or so. And I know that they were really pushing hard to try to get the states on board. Since we meet every other year, as a legislature, it is possible during the off year that they may reach that 35, but I think it's just a gamble we take, and maybe we don't need to worry about it at this point.
Well, and it might make sense just to send it down in Ways and Means to make sure that transfer occurs of the existing authority, and then given the budget climate we're in, I'd say I wouldn't lay big odds on it getting an additional appropriation anyway. Senator Byers?
Madam Chair, on that point, and unless Council or you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that transfer won't happen unless a bill happens. Well, if you send this bill to Ways and Means and they don't pass the bill, they're not going to transfer that authority, because this bill, this amendment is what transfers that authority. A bill has to pass in order for that to happen. The Ways and Means just won't do that without a bill.
Well, actually, that's true, but I'm not sure that they would have to pass the whole.
They could adjust or modify it in Ways and Means.
Yeah, they could take out the juvenile compact part and put in the.
Just the dash ones.
Just the dash one.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
The other issue was Mr. Masters, who was special counsel for Council of State Governments and testified, he said that North Dakota put a sunset provision in to see if they wanted to stay in to the compact, so that can also be done too. Mm-hmm. And they can certainly do that in Ways and Means when they're looking at the fiscal.
Yeah, so the question is really before us is whether we should retool this and just do the transfer now and hold up on the overall compact, or whether we should just send the whole thing down to Ways and Means and see how much of it they go for. Council, do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would seem one way or the other if we were to say, for example, take out, have the Stash 1 amendment be substituted for the bill, which would keep us within the current compact as opposed to moving us towards the new compact, we would still have to send it to Ways and Means Committee for the need to transfer the funds over.
Correct.
So regardless of what we do, the bill goes to Ways and Means Committee unless we decide to leave it here.
Well, so it then becomes an issue of how comfortable people are with the compact itself. You were our council, and we're committee members who don't know, play a very active role in drafting this compact. And I'm comfortable with it, but these are tough times. Senator Whitsitt doesn't look comfortable with it.
Sure, Burdick, I'm not comfortable with the compact. I just have a visceral concern for an appointed commission. It's not even appointed by our own governor, with the authority to levy taxes on Oregonians and to write statutes that Oregonians must obey. I realize there is an escape hatch that the legislature can write a statute that negates joining of the compact. But there's also another possibility. What if the compact has been ratified by Congress and then it becomes a federal law, then we're stuck with it. And that does happen with compacts.
They become federal law.
Mm-hmm. I can't support that.
If the compact is adopted by the 35 states and Oregon is a member of the compact, its regulations are binding on Oregon. That would be both under the interstate compact clause and I guess also under contract theory, in the sense that we've entered into a contract theory. Now, it does say that it does not supersede our Constitution. Absent that provision, it very well could supersede our Constitution, because that's what the federal law states as it relates to interstate compacts. So that is a fairly accurate statement, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. We're going to close the work session on this and take under advisement the whether it's worth coming back with the Dash 1 Amendment. Close the work session. I think we'll take up audio-visual recording. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 368. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 368 comes to you, sponsored by Senator Deckett and Representative Brooke Gerard at the request of the Motion Picture Association of America. It prohibits the audiovisual recording in movie theaters and movies being exhibited on movie screen without the written consent of the theater owner, allows a theater or the owner's employees to detain a probable cause to believe a person using a recording device to record the movie being played, defines audiovisual recording. Madam Chairman of the Committee, we have the Dash 1 amendments before us, too.
Okay. Let's see. Do we have a work group on this?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. We simply have the Dash 1 amendments. And
we had that presentation from a person that came in from the movie industry. Instead of Warren Beatty or whoever.
Yeah, okay. See, when Warren Beatty boogied out, I just lost interest in that.
Yeah, I think what happened here, Madam Chair, my notes indicate that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association had an immunity fix that they wanted on the bill, and that's why you see this.
That's correct.
Amendment.
That brings back my memory. Okay. All right. Are there any questions from the committee on this? We have Mr. Hughes there in the audience.
Yep.
368. And anybody from the trial lawyers here? Yeah. Do I see nodding heads in the whole room? Okay. Senator Starr, do you have an opinion on the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, I think they're appropriate.
Good. Senator Starr moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 368. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Why do you have a lot of words in
Senator,
there?
Yes.
Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 368 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 368 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I'll carry this. Okay, what do we have left here? Water. Let's talk about water. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 940. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 940 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary. Allows a former owner whose property has been foreclosed and sold at a foreclosure sale for failure to pay an irrigation district assessment 90 days to redeem the property by paying all the costs incurred by the district, including unpaid assessment and the cost of foreclosure.
And we should have an amendment here.
Madam Chair, we have the dashboard amendments before us. Which go to page 2, lines 1 and 2, insert all the amount of purchase money paid by the property at time of sheriff sale, and this clarifies what has to be paid if the property is redeemed.
Okay, and I had asked the sponsors of this bill to go find other similar situations and how much of a grace period those situations provided. They came back and said that they found that most such situations have provided 180 days, and this one provides 90 days. So this is really a more conservative approach than under other provisions of law, according to the proponents. And we have Christina McNeil here if anybody has questions. So I am comfortable with the dash one amendment if others are. Andrew Starr?
Yes, Madam Chair. The dash one amendments clarify what is considered as cost for which redemption must be paid. And I move those amendments to Senate Bill 940, the dash one.
Senator Starr moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 940. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 940 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 940 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
Yes. I do have a concern about this bill. Ms. McNitt and Winkler were emphatic in pointing out that water rights pertinent to land are separable from the land. This would appear to me that the district could foreclose on the land and then separate off the water right. And it's not at all clear whether the redemption would include the opportunity to redeem the water right or not.
Let's have Ms. McNitt come up and elaborate on that point if she's available to. I'm disappointed to hear you express an objection, Senator Whitsitt, since I had you all picked out as a carrier, since you're so interested in water law. So let's see if we can solve your concerns here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, for the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress. And Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, to answer your question, I don't believe that Senate Bill 940 really addresses who owns a water right or land at all. And in fact, we're trying to provide a situation or an opportunity for a landowner who may or may not have a water right attached to that land, but who has indeed not paid the fees associated with receiving benefits from being inside a district and therefore has lost ownership of that land and or water right. Right now, under irrigation district foreclosure statutes, we have no way of, as a district, of providing any opportunity for a landowner to go back and purchase that property back after the sheriff's sale. So we're simply trying to provide an opportunity similar to other foreclosure statutes that would allow the landowner to make good on that debt and bring that property back into their ownership.
Senator Whitsitt?
Ms. McNitt. Did Council want to say something?
No, I think he's just looking for class. Oh, you have a comment?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the bill. In current law, this would be in Section 1, says if land in two or more counties is to be foreclosed. And then in Section 26, it says property sold. So I don't know that much about water, but I know a little bit about foreclosures and these kind of actions. And with property sold under this section, they can't sell any more than they have. So if there's a foreclosure on a piece of property and you buy a foreclosure, you get what's being sold. And if the water attaches, then you get that. If it's not attached, then you don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the property sold may be redeemed. So if you are redeeming it, you're redeeming whatever was sold. Does that make any sense, Simon?
So you're assuring me that if, certainly when the land is foreclosed on, it has a water right on it, the water right will go with that land because the original owner has no basis to separate it. And as a matter of fact, the water right, like in Eastern Oregon, makes up 90% of the value of the land, so they're not going to separate it. And you're suggesting that I should be comfortable that that if the original owner redeemed the land, they would redeem it on the same basis in which it was foreclosed upon.
And Chairman, as a committee, if the person if the owner redeems the property, they get back what was sold at the foreclosure sale.
Okay.
No more, no less.
Okay.
Which includes water
rights. May or may not include water rights.
May or may not.
I'm Chairman of the committee. I know very little about water rights, so I mm-hmm. it's once again it goes back to what was sold. If they sold the land with the water rights and you redeem it, that's what you get back. Okay. If they sold it without the water rights and you redeem it, you get it without the water rights.
But this bill does nothing to address one way or the other any separation of land from water rights.
Madam Chair, I can't say anything there. It says property sold under this section may be redeemed. That relates back to Section 1.
This is just a redemption as to whatever has transpired.
That's right. Correct.
Senator Whitsitt, I hope and pray you're comfortable with this. But
put it on the record on the
floor. Council has made it clear that he believes that the entire package would be redeemable as it was foreclosed upon, and I'm comfortable if that's the case.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so we have the debt. Have we already adopted the Dash 1?
No.
No.
We just talked about the Dash 1.
All right. Are there any objections to the Dash 1 amendment? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 940 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 940 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
You've got somebody over there.
That you'd already moved the Dash 1, no objection.
I thought so.
You'd already moved due pass amended.
This is going to be really, really one of the most passed bills in the session.
Yeah, it will be.
Are there any objections?
I just want to make a comment, Madam Chair. I think it's a darn good bill because it gives landowners the opportunity to go back and redeem just for an unpaid water bill. I think this is a really good bill. So.
As someone who's occasionally late with her water bill during session, I really appreciate this bill, although they haven't foreclosed on me yet. Okay, any objections? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, I beg you. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt will carry this, and that will give you an opportunity to put those issues on the record, Senator Whitsitt.
Will you carry it twice?
Senator Whitsitt is our water law expert on this committee, so we appreciate having him. Okay, let's see. Let's try to do one more. We will open the work session on Senate Bill 946.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 946 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. We have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you. Requires a trial by hearing where the defendant is charged in murder, aggravated murder, that written report of the proceedings be kept by a court reporter. That would be the official court record. The Dash 2 amendments require the State Court Administrator to pay the cost of sonographic recording services, require the State Court Administrator to select these services through a competitive bidding, requires that all reporting services be chosen be certified. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and this bill was last before us on March 21st.
Okay, and does this have to go to Ways and Means?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does. It has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. All right, and let's see, we have a Dash 1.
No, Dash 2.
Madam Chair, and then we have a Dash 2. The Dash 2 amendments is
was the sense of the committee afterwards.
Okay, so dash one are no longer relevant.
Correct. Okay. I believe they're no longer relevant, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Walker, do you have any further elucidation on this bill?
No, Madam Chair, we took the comments of the committee to heart. The committee was very concerned about the discombobulated way we were going to fund that. So we reconfigured that, and we have in there that you're a certified reporter, whether it's under state law or national organization, which is a very good thing, and competitive bidding. And I think this is a good fix, and if there's money in the budget, we get it.
Thank you very much.
It's appropriate to go to Ways and Means.
Senator Pruzanski.
And the Office of the State Court Administrator is the one that actually would be handling the bill, not the parties, et cetera.
Right.
As the original bill said.
And that's why it goes to Ways and Means. Okay. Senator Starr, we're looking for a motion on the Dash 2 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the Dash 2 amendments.
It was.
To Senate Bill 946.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 946. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, we're looking for a motion to refer this to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 946 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. With a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 946 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you very much.
She's a woman of few words.